This is CliffCentral.com.
Sia's new favorite song. It's James Arthur with Say You Won't Let Go. It's a Tuesday morning, CliffCentral.com. Thursday and Friday, I'm in Cape Town, and the team will be holding things down here, but we've got some amazing guests lined up for you. I've actually spoken to a couple of really interesting people in the last few days that we pre-recorded, and we'll be playing them out in the next day or two, and you'll get to hear all of them. Morgan Freeman was on the Graham Norton show, and he reenacted a scene from The Shawshank Redemption. I thought you might enjoy this. This is pretty funny. I love that show, by the way. When I do see it, it's not... I don't watch it all the time, but whenever I see a clip, usually online, because I don't even know what channel it's on.
It's on BBC
Lifestyle.
120, that's okay. All I know.
All right, well, I've never seen it live, so I always watch clips after it's happened, and this is one of them that someone threw up on my Facebook feed.
Talking of hit movies, Shawshank Redemption, obviously, you know,
great movie.
One of your most... Yes, everyone loves a movie. If that's one of those movies, anyone puts their, you know, best films of all time list together, it's always on.
Yeah, it's always on there.
It's always on there.
That's Michael Caine. He says, yes, it's always on there. He's sitting with Morgan Freeman. So this is a hell of a star-studded lineup. This Graham Norton
always do it with these shows.
He gets great guests. So he's got Morgan Freeman sitting next to Sir Michael Caine. And the two of them are talking about their favorite movies.
Film has never been a
tanked
hit.
At the box office. And the reason for that is, of course, is that The only real marketing movies get, I think, is word of mouth. You can promote it all you want, but if the first few audiences go there and come back and can't say, I really saw this great film, then you're not going to go very far. Though people went to see the Shawshank Redemption and then they came back, oh, man, I saw this really terrific movie. It's called the... Shank Sham. Shim Shark. One lady saw me in the elevator one time. She said, oh, I saw you in the Hudsucker Reduction.
The Hudsucker Reduction.
So if you can't get word across, then it just doesn't do well.
Yeah,
you know, just, you can't say it.
That's why Alfie did well.
Yeah. And is that the film that turned you into sort of Mr. Narration?
Yeah, that was it.
Because it's so special, that narration. And now, we have got a little kind of Shawshank mashup. So would you mind lending your voice to it?
I go on.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so here he is.
I must admit I didn't think much of Graham Norton first time I laid eyes on him. Looked like a stiff breeze could blow him over. That was my first impression of the man. I could see why some people took him for annoying. He had a walk and a talk that just wasn't normal around here. And boy, did he drink. He drank like a man without a care or worry in the world. I hope to finish this talk show one day. I hope Michael stops talking for just one second. I hope people stop asking me to do stupid voiceovers like this. I hope.
Oh, very good. Very good.
He's so good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is so good. He really is the voice of God, right?
He is, definitely.
I'm just amazed. I love Michael Caine. I love Morgan Freeman. Imagine having them both sitting on your... So for their talking shit to you.
And they get them liquored up on that show,
yeah.
Hey?
Yeah, it's good. It's a good move.
But it's kind of like that show's whole thing now is what would be your ideal perfect fantasy lounge conversation? Because normally you get like one guest and a couple of like maybe British stage stars or whatever. But now they just have heavy hitting guests every episode.
I mean, you had Tom Hanks. Did you ever see him doing the Forrest Gump thing? We got some time before our guests come in. Listen to this quickly.
A very sexy sport. Proof of that is Mr. Tom Hanks. Because I believe your wife, her one of her favorite scenes is you running.
Oh dear. The running away scene. Yeah. Yes. Every interview will be about Forrest Gump at some point. You know, you'll have the same thing. You'll be answering questions about St. Joan for the rest of your life. I had done not the workouts, but I had worked out quite a bit, and it was all about running. And I must say that my buttocks, as Forrest would say,
my buttocks,
as firm as tinned hams. They were just the. I mean, look, I've seen the movie, and I've seen it, and every now and again, if it comes by on the cable, my wife will say, just leave it here, honey. I just want to see that one scene where you're running away from the camera. And we can look at that fine Hank's ass. it's not there anymore. But in the day, man, it was, I mean, I must say, I even think it's a beautiful thing to behold.
And actually, there's another link between Mo and Tom, because the last time you were on, you remember those memes that people would do, the Mo Farah running away from things? So, Mo Farah running away from a bear.
Oh.
Mo Farah in a bull run. Mo Farah in the Sound of Music. And there is one of Mo Farah running away from Forrest Gump.
Oh, really?
One of the reasons, like, I've always remembered Tom, and obviously it's amazing what he does, says when you go for a run, Forrest, run!
Which is rude.
But it's a nice thing, it's a compliment.
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah.
You've got to think, you go to all that trouble of becoming a famous runner, and they're still calling you another name. How hard is Mo?
Run, Farah, run. That could work. See, there you go. Run, Farah, run. Take it, folks. It is my good friend to you.
they are. Actually, could you do a lovely thing, Tom? Could you do a lovely thing? Just because Mo's here, he's the greatest runner in the world. Could you do the line from Forrest Gump where he suddenly discovers how much he likes running?
I would happy to do it, but you must show the lady with the cue card, because otherwise people will think that I've actually memorized this. Show the lady with the cue card. Cut over to her. Just show it. See?
There she is. She's there.
I will, in fact, do it. Okay, so it goes...
This is for you, Mo. This is
for you, Mo. And now, you wouldn't believe it, me, if I told you, but I could run like the wind blows. From that day on, if I was going somewhere, I was running good.
All right, very nice. A little nostalgia. What are your favorite movies? I mean, I liked Shawshank Redemption. It's in my top 10, as Michael Caine said.
Yeah, that's one of those movies everyone has to watch.
My favorite movie is Remains of the Day.
I've never heard of that.
Emma Thompson, Anthony Hopkins. Beautiful, beautiful movie. Just this whole unrequited love thing. It's really spectacularly good.
Ooh.
I think Christopher Reeve was in it as well.
Hugh Grant.
Yeah, it was good. It was just such a great movie. Everything is so subtle in that movie. Nothing is... I don't think any voices are raised. It's just so subtle. And you have to read into people's eyes and into their smiles. And they don't give anything away.
Jeez,
it's so
it looks
beautifully
quite dark.
Done. No, it's great. It's just such a great movie. Man, I like it because it's, you know, not set in today. I like movies that are set a while back. And you need to know exactly where. It's beautifully done. Everything about that movie was just magnificent. So Shawshank, that one. And, of course, all the various Transformers and Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah, all
of course. Yeah. They will go down in history as just great.
The best, right?
Cinematography / script writing / action, whatnot.
Let's bring our guests in. Let's get to meet them this morning. We are talking about two very, very talented and successful people in South Africa, Nondumiso Tembe and Andile Gumbi, who are both starring in the King Kong musical, which has just started. I saw a poster for that the other day. And they are also, in their own right, each of them, very, very successful people, have done amazing work before. Nondumiso is a multi-award winning actress, singer, songwriter, dancer, and she starred in a number of movies. Mubs is looking up her CV just a little earlier on.
Very impressive.
When she heard she was coming in, absolutely. And Andile himself has a very, very interesting CV too. He's 31 years old, Durban-born, did The Lion King in Australia in 2004, South Africa, London, New York. I mean, that's, if you're in musical theatre and you've done all of that, you've pretty much done it all. You may as well quit right now. You're at the top of your game.
Hey, now.
Wow. That's just The Lion King. Then he did Dance Through Me. He did Animal Farm, Gonyeni High. He's done an internationally acclaimed miniseries called Book of Negroes with Nondumiso, which aired on BET. He was voted by the Sowetan as one of Mzansi's top 12 sexiest celebs in 2015. Yeah, so the guy has done a lot, and we'll talk about the musical King Kong in a minute. But really, Nondumiso, I've got like a page on you here. I don't even know if I should go into this, because it's almost, you know when someone gives you too much of an intro?
But why y'all gotta play the music though?
I have to play the music.
Why y'all gotta play the music?
Special effects.
Do it. You're important guests. I've got to give you the trumpets.
So, Vonnegut, thank you so much for having us and supporting our show. Very well.
All right, so let's start with that, because I know that you're not here for your health. So tell me about this musical, King Kong the musical.
Firstly, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you.
And, King Kong the musical.
Yeah,
and we all, a lot of us know the history of it and how iconic it was when it first came out in the 50s, and it helped launch careers of like the great Miriam Makeba's, Hugh Masekela's, and they all were in that show, and then it toured South Africa for a long time, and also it went overseas in London. And so to be part of this show, to be part of this new family that is kind of bringing back this iconic giant of a musical, it's a huge pleasure, and it's a huge challenge on us as well. It's you know, to work with Nondumiso again, because I worked with her on Book of Negroes, so it's been an amazing experience so far. And the story of King Kong, it's all about Ezekiel Dlamini.
That's right, the boxer.
The
right?
boxer. Yeah.
A lot of people go, "Oh, King Kong, that's about the gorilla on the Empire State Building."
Oh gosh! In fact, we have a lot of like hidden jokes in the show about that.
Yeah, pretty much.
So yeah, it's 50 years since the original performance.
Almost
right?
60, actually.
In Sophia Town.
58 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you think about that, and how Miriam Makeba became like a household name after that show. Mm. And it really launched her. And Ezekiel Dlamini, tell me about him.
Ezekiel Dlamini was a guy who was born in Vryheid, KZN. Grew up there, and he was a larger-than-life kind of a character. He was a very big man, and he moved to Durban, did some gardening work there, and he always wanted more, wanted more with his life. And then he moved to Joburg, and moved to Sophia Town. And he used to always box around, used his physique to, you know, get through life. We worked as a bouncer at some point in different clubs, discos maybe at the time. And then through his love of boxing, he would also just go into, he met these people who were boxing with, he calls them cushions on their hands. And he was like, "Oh, this is a joke. How can you, you know?"
Because he never used those.
No.
Big man.
You know, and so this trainer one time, I can't remember his name. He was, they were getting annoyed by the fact that he was picking on them. And then the trainer said, "Okay, do you want to fight?" Ezekiel wanted to fight the trainer. And the trainer was a bit smaller than him, but he took him on, and then the trainer taught him a lesson. And then from that point, he really respected the art of boxing, and then he started training and fought and became one of the greatest fighters in South Africa. But his crazy side, his mental side, like I would say, sort of like got the better of him in a way that he used to get into fights, like outside boxing, like street fights and stuff like that. And he was, when he moved to Sophia Town, he was targeted by a lot of gangsters then, because he thought he was this biggest man.
But it is also like it's an imposing thing. If you're a big guy and you're well known for being quite physical, then other guys need to prove that they're men by taking you on.
Mm-hmm. So, exactly.
So stupid. Kind of, we're still doing it now. It's 2017. Nothing's changed. So you're Ezekiel in the show.
Yes.
I mean, you're a big imposing man too. How tall are you?
I'm 6'2".
Yeah.
That's 186, 187.
Yeah, you're no small guy. See, I want to fight you at the end of this, but yeah.
That's why we really brought you.
I brought some gloves. Life imitating art.
So, Andile, looking at, and Nondumi, so I'm going to keep you in reserve here. We get to you in a second.
I'm scared.
Andile, this is some list of things that you've already done, man. I mean, when you've performed on the West End and on Broadway.
Musical
theater terms, you're in the rarefied air of being a superstar then in musical theater. That doesn't get better than that.
Like Broadway and West End, equally, they kind of sort of like the Hollywood in terms of the movie world. And so it's funny, when I got into theater, I never knew that. I never knew about Broadway. I never knew about, West End and stuff like that. I just did it for the love of it. And I never knew that the small decisions that I took with my life would channel me towards this journey. And because I remember when I auditioned for Lion King, actually, I was studying drama at DUT. This was 2004. Mm-hmm. And I was literally walking through town. I had no idea about this. And I met these guys that I knew. And they were like, oh, there's some auditions at the Playhouse.
For what?
For Lion King. Lion King, the movie? And it didn't make sense to me. And I just had time to spare, and I walked in. There was a huge crowd of people there auditioning. Went in. It was a Friday. Mm-hmm. Sang for them. And
who was auditioning you?
Dumandlovu.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah, Dumandlovu, because he's sort of like the agent for all South African performers who are taken to join Lion Kings around the world. So I got there and I sang, and they liked my voice, gave me a CD to learn one of the songs there and a script. So I came back Sunday and I did it for them. I performed, they put it on tape, and after that it was just like silence for quite a while. And then I got a call, I think a couple of months later.
Did you think at that point I haven't got it?
I did think so, because it was like... the music was just too big. I was like, no, who would sing this kind of music? It's not, I can never do this. This is too big for me. And then I came back, and the international creatives were there. You know, Maria Griffith, John Stefanik. Everybody was there. And I sang and I acted for them. And you can see when you're auditioning, and you can see people that they are enjoying your performance, your audition. And I was like, okay, this is not going that
bad. Good, yeah.
It might be good. And you see them nodding, smiling a little bit. I'm like, okay, cool, this is going well. All right. I finished, took some pictures, and I left. Again, 3 months went by. Yep. Nothing happened. I was like, it was never meant to be. And then I, all of a sudden, just got this call from this guy with an Australian accent. And he told me, we would like you to come and join the Australian company of Lion King. We would like you to start. I think I had like maybe four weeks. Oof. And I was like, yeah. Started doing all my visa applications. Did not tell my mother.
Oh. How old were you at this stage?
I was 20.
You're
approaching 20.
Wow. Still young.
Yeah. I got to Australia 2 weeks before my 21st. So I never celebrated my 21st.
Because Australians are no fun.
Right.
And also, you would have family and friends. Yeah, and at that time, I was still finding my feet and stuff like that.
Did you call your mom from Australia and be like, yeah, hi, mom. So,
by the way, remember? Now, eventually, I told her, but she wasn't sure. And at that time, there was all this thing that was happening, like when people were getting used to traffic drugs and stuff.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Right.
Did she think you were doing that?
Yeah. No, she wasn't sure. Shame. She was very worried. And I was young.
Oh my God.
I was 20. Yeah. And,
she didn't go, I've got this talented kid. She's like, oh God, he's a drug dealer.
He's a drug mule. He's going to be a drug mule. Oh,
man. My son's going to go to Singapore
That's
jail.
That's it. Never going to see him.
Never see him.
So when you're in London and the West End, or you're on Broadway, you're working the whole time. You don't have a chance actually to take it in and go, whoa, I'm on the most important musical theatre stage in the world here.
Because
you're thinking about the work, or am I reading it wrong?
No. Actually, you're right. You are right, because you're always focusing on, you know, making sure that you're keeping fit and healthy. Sure. Your voice should be top condition all the time. And so you're really not thinking too much about the outside picture of what it is that you're actually doing. Mm. The one thing that used to get me the most was the actual response from the audience, from people when they recognize you, because you get a lot of people that are being recognized through TV, because TV, you know, everybody watches TV.
So sure.
Not a lot of people watch theater.
Yeah.
So when you have people recognize you from the show, that's one thing. I'm like, oh, okay, all right, okay, cool.
That's pretty cool.
You know, at the end of the show, there's people at stage door. They want your autographs. They're taking pictures with you, and Disney at the time when I got there, they did this international ad campaign where they did posters of Lion King with me,
mm-hmm.
and that went all around the world. They used them in New York, they used them in Germany, even I think in Japan as well.
It's still actually up in London.
I think it's
at the airport.
Do you get paid every time they use that?
No, <Yes.
laughs> you do.
No, I did get paid at the time, but it was a different understanding, a different contract. Yes, right. Once off kind of situation. And I remember Jonathan Manby, King Kong director. When he got to London at some point, the picture was there.
Heathrow Airport.
He stood there and took a picture and then sent it to me. So which was quite fun.
That's so cool.
So it's those things that kind of and this one was the best one for me. I'm sorry. When I got to Broadway the very first time, you know how Times Square is, like lights, hectic. Everything. You know,
traffic, people. Yeah, and people. Insane.
And I stood there, and then they started playing, like showing clips of the Lion King stuff, and I saw my face there, and I was like,
in Times Square on a billboard,
right there. And I stood there for a second. I was busy taking pictures around, and I see it, and I'm like, that's me. And I was like, nope. And I was just,
Mama, I made it.
Exactly. It was that moment.
That is a moment in making. I mean, that you don't get better when your face is up in Times Square.
Yeah.
You're the king of the world.
It was the most humbling experience ever. And I will never, ever forget that day. You know?
Did anyone see you and go, hey, that's you?
No. I had a full beard.
Because they're all doing their own thing. Yeah, as well.
Exactly. Right? New York, they're all about their business. Yeah, it was so much fun. Wow.
Now, Nondumiso.
That's amazing. That's a great story.
I mean, you're based in LA now.
I am, yeah. I have been for the last 8 years. Before that, I was on the East Coast in New York and in grad school, etc.
Yeah, you've done a lot. But you did Yale School of Drama.
I got my master's degree.
Right. Yeah. Studied ballet, African dance. Let me just go through some of this.
No, Gareth!
Just hold on. This
guys!
Important. Just wait.
I'm going
to people need to know this stuff.
People got to know.
These are your heirs.
And what I love is that all of your stuff, you've always focused on, like, wherever you could, on African music, African culture, African dance. You're proud of where you come from.
I am.
Which I love, because so many people, it would be easy for you to just become another terrific actress in LA and, you know,
assimilate.
All of those things. Yeah, you could easily do that, but you've kept that African flag flying high.
Thank you.
So,
that's important.
First of all, I want to talk to you about True Blood.
Oh, yeah.
Because that won so many awards, and I remember us watching. Mubs, you remember True Blood?
It was
such a great show.
Such a big show during its day.
I know. I mean, it was like a cult. There was a cult following.
Yes,
it was crazy.
That's the word I was looking for.
And that role, Mavis?
Yeah.
What was
Mavis
that like?
The ghost.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's amazing to be part of something that huge and something that popular and so relevant in pop culture. So, and that was sort of, I would say, I had been working kind of steadily as a young actress in Hollywood, but that was pretty early in my transition from the world of theater,
right.
And also graduating from grad school and then transitioning into Hollywood and the world
of film
and television.
Did you know you were on a hit show?
I mean,
when you were
I knew it was True Blood, and it was Alan Ball himself who cast me. But I was on season 4, so the show was already very established and popular. But you can imagine my first day at work, you know, meeting Anna Paquin in the makeup trailer and working with the likes of Joe Manganiello, whom I was reunited with, actually, and was sort of the female lead opposite in a TV show that we filmed last year called Six. Unfortunately, he got sick and could no longer be a part of it. But
that was with the Weinstein company,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and really kind of another breakthrough in my career as well. But yeah, I mean, I understood what the moment I think I was standing in terms of True Blood. I understood that it was a big deal and a big break for me in my career, but it also was really just about doing the work, because, you know, in the world of episodic television, film, it's a little different, but in Hollywood and episodic television, the turnaround is so quick. There's no time to do anything. I think I was cast on Thursday, and on Friday morning, I was... The on very set. Next day, I was, on set, not shooting, but already, you know, in wardrobe and hair and makeup. And then, of course, I was playing a Creole woman. So dialect consultations with a dialect coach. It was very intense. And they all sort of descended upon me, the entire team. And then on Monday, I was shooting. So so I had just a couple of days to learn my script. And it was pretty intense. And, of course, I was speaking Creole and French. So it was a lot. So there wasn't kind of... Like Andile was describing his experience, you are really focused on the work and you are feeling very overwhelmed and a little bit intimidated in the moment. And you know you have to bring your best and you have a lot to prove. And I was the new kid in school. So it was only later, I think, in particular when the South African press got wind of it and really showed such tremendous support and you know, just pride, I suppose.
Absolutely.
That I was then able to take a step back and be like, okay.
We're always so excited when one of our own does well over there, and not because we think that they haven't done well. I mean, you've done very well over here as well. You were in Generations. There were so many things that you did that
Thank
were
you.
Huge. But musical theatre versus acting in a TV series or in a movie,
yeah.
And they're very different things, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think fundamentally, as an actor, good acting is good acting, no matter the medium. And you're always focused on just telling the truth and being authentic and grounded and creating multidimensional dynamic human beings and telling an interesting and dynamic and relatable story for the audience. So I think that's always the foundation from which you are working, no matter what your medium. But yes, I mean, it was a difficult transition for me because just technically speaking, when your background is primarily in theater and the performing arts and as a singer and sort of live performance, and that's where the majority of my training is, there is a huge technical adjustment you have to make for the camera. And it took me several years to get comfortable in front of the camera and to also just understand how to work well with the camera, especially when you're working on multi-camera productions where you have, like we had in Book of Negroes, where you have sort of three different cameras. It's all different, shooting you from all different angles. Just understanding the technical demands and just how to be effective in film and television is what was tough for me. You know, it took, I don't want to say tough, it took... discipline and skill and focus and some time for me to get used to and understand that medium. But I do feel that now I am very comfortable and confident in front of the camera. And it's even small things like I know that I have an understanding your own kind of quirks and tendencies as an actor. I know that I have a very expressive face. In particular, my eyes are very expressive. And there's a certain pitch and scale that you have where you have to kind of... blast your performance through, you know, to an audience in a big theater so that your performance translates equally as powerfully to the person sitting at the very last row and to the equally to the person sitting in the first row. But with film and television, where everything is right here, right up close and tight in your face, every flicker of your eye, every twitch of an eyebrow means something. And so, you know...
Also, you can be super intimate and soft. Right?
Yeah, it was a big lesson in totally not pivoting to King Kong, but I can't ignore this parallel. Our story is sort of a cautionary tale about understanding and owning your power, but also taking responsibility for your power through watching the rise and fall of this great man. And I feel like likewise, what I've learned working in film and television is how to harness my power.
Must be cool to have all of these skills in your armory. Like you've got this ability now to do all of them. You've done movies as well. Movies are very different to TV. And isn't it amazing how television has taken some of the best actors and actresses away from film?
Yeah.
Huh? I mean, that's exciting because it used to be that TV was the ugly stepchild of the movie industry. And now it's the other way around. You get all these A-listers going to do TV shows. First of all, it's at least 13 episodes. You've got a guaranteed paycheck over a certain period of time. You get this consistency into your life.
Right.
You're not always running to auditions or being pitched for this and pitched for that and being put onto receiving scripts for 1,000 different shows. Yeah. It's cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's just such... there's such great material now out there for film and television. One, because, you know, in the kind of digital age, there's just been this explosion of different platforms now where it's not just a few stations on television, but you have even Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, all of these different digital platforms producing incredible, dynamic, really rich material where each episode is shot like a movie and they have budgets for the entire season, you know, almost like a film. And so there's a huge draw there, and there's really great roles and material there for some of the best actors in the world and movie stars to sink their teeth into. So it's been really great because Hollywood took a very big hit and there was a big dip around from sort of 2005, 2006 after the U.S. economy crashed, but also there was a writer's strike. So when I actually moved to Hollywood in 2009, it was pretty quiet and really difficult. There were not a lot of roles and really the meaty role. There was a lot of competition, in particular as a woman of color and a young face emerging and trying to break through. There were not a lot of opportunities, and I've seen this new explosion steadily build, and you almost can't keep up with the with the number of auditions and the opportunities.
So much of it is about the work. Like, you have to have work lined up. And people don't understand this. As an actor, actress, musical theater performer, you need like a bit of a plan.
Yeah.
You need to know that in May next year, you're going to be here doing this. Because if you don't plan it that way, and if you don't have stuff lined up, you don't know whether you're going to have income that month.
Yeah.
And even for successful, you know, people who we all look up to in that world, sometimes there are a couple of weeks, months where they don't have anything lined up, or something gets canceled, or they, you know, they can a series early, or whatever the case may be. It's a really tough business.
It is.
It'll eat you alive if you don't have the self-confidence to maintain yourself, right?
Yeah, and I kind of wish that young people understood that. You know, I talk to and sort of mentor, or I'm approached to mentor a lot of young South African artists who kind of would like some guidance on how to break into the international scene and just kind of what steps to follow. And, you know, unfortunately, I feel like I sort of burst their bubble because they see and get excited by the very glamorous kind of...
you're having lunch at the Four Seasons every
day. Right, and I'm into designer dresses every day sitting drinking champagne with Steven Spielberg.
And when you're not sitting on a set, you're just chilling, they think that you're at an awards show or you're flying from A to B.
Some magazine cover shoot for Vogue and Rome. See,
and this is the part that I'm interested in, is learning those lines. I mean, where do you do this? How do you do that? How do you get it into your head? That would drive me crazy. If I looked at a script, and some of these are long.
Yeah.
You have to memorize monologues and crazy stuff.
Yeah. And also, like, it's very difficult, speaking of like learning lines and stuff like that. It's that thing of there's different approaches with everything, like in terms of TV and theater.
Most. Even in if you lose your lines in theater, you can't do another take.
That's the thing. Yeah, you don't. There's no cuts. There's nothing you can do.
Have you ever got into a song? I mean, when you were doing Lion King, and you must know those songs like the back of your hand.
I have.
But there must have been a point somewhere in one of the shows of shit! Yeah. I have no idea what the next line is. What do you do?
You keep going.
Yeah. Or you look at your scene partner with panic, like happens like, with us all the time, and you're like, help, help, help.
Like, true story, I was playing Simba, because I'm in Australia. I started there as an ensemble and then understudied Simba.
Yeah.
So one time I got on to play Simba, and I had fun, and I was singing Can You Feel the Love Tonight with opposite the girl who played Nala at the time. And my lyrics are so many things to tell her, but how to make her see the truth about my past impossible. So, you know, when you're singing, you're thinking about the next line. So, right. I started, so many things to tell her, blank. Following line, blank.
Oh.
So many things to tell her, something about my life. I just kept quiet. I was like, impossible. Kept on going. And I turn around and I look at all the guys, like ensemble guys on stage. They are shaking like this
with
laughter. And it was the most.
But people are meant to support you. All they're doing is laughing, right?
But no, the funny thing is, because at that time I was very young. I was new and, you know, big productions like that. It got to me.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the show, I was so mad.
Did it hit you hard?
Yeah, I was so mad. I was so upset with myself. And everybody was like, no, forget about it. Forget about it. I was like, no, I can't.
Did you think this is the end of my career?
I didn't go that far, but I was like, if that happens to me, then maybe I doubted myself.
Mm.
And then it happened one time again, and I was like, okay. Then it happened to somebody else, and I was like, okay, so this happens. You know, in live theater, it happens. You just have to be professional enough to find a way to get yourself out of this, of that whatever point you're stuck in.
Because isn't the chance that the audience don't necessarily know that you've made a mistake?
That's
they're none the wiser.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So if you find a way to get yourself out of a situation, they may never know that you made a mistake. And so it's what you were talking about, like talking to guys who want to get into the theater or this industry. And you talk to them and they don't necessarily know that, you know, so you have to kind of make them aware of, it's not just about being in front of a camera. You know, you have to remember your lines, you have to research your character, you have to find the depth of what kind of story you're trying to tell to the audience and how you want them to relate to your character, the way you present your character.
Yeah.
So it's all those things that are very important. And so it's not just what we were talking about. It's not just, you know, having dinner somewhere or going.
That's actually the smallest part of it. The life of an artist is a life of dedication to your craft, extraordinary discipline, sacrifice, focus, relentless hard work, long hours, early mornings,
mm-hmm.
as you said, times of periods of financial instability,
mm-hmm.
challenges in your personal life and personal relationships because of being away and traveling so much. I mean, it really is. It's like being a soldier in an army or a professional athlete, really. Your whole life is sort of dedicated to your craft, and it really takes a lot to perform and operate consistently at your best.
And you have to be ready to go whenever you're called. Like, if there's an opportunity, you've got to grab it with both hands whenever it comes up, right?
I suppose so, but I think I've gotten to, and I imagine you have too, Andile, I've gotten to a point in my career where I think I've earned the right to be a little bit selective and circumspect.
Sure.
And also just as a human being and as an artist, I'm very clear on what kind of artist I want to be and what my voice is and the kind of work that I want to share with the world.
Have you ever said yes to a project that you're in for 6 months? Like, you know, a musical it's not a 2 week thing and then you're done.
Right.
Mm. And you've said yes to it and then something else came up that was so much better and you thought, oh, I shouldn't have said yes to this.
To this? Go ahead.
I just think sometimes it has happened. It happens, and I think sometimes you just need to be content sometimes, and just know that wherever you are at that time, that's where you're supposed to be.
Mm.
And also, like what you were talking about before, planning ahead and knowing what's happening maybe in a year's time or 2 years' time. So it's always that thing of you understand yourself as an actor of where you are in terms of your craft,
mm-hmm.
or how well you've improved on one thing or you're lacking in another thing. And so in regards to your journey that you want to be on with your career, you tend to make those decisions based on that. Like, for instance, after coming back from, because theater was my first love. So after coming back from overseas and I got into TV and I was doing TV, it was a huge adjustment for me as well, like having to tone everything down for the camera. And I was having fun. I had fun, and I still have fun whenever I do TV, and I'd love to go back and do TV again. But I got to a point where I was like, okay, I feel like I need theater now, you know, so that I can.
What is, okay, is that about the audience and that energy you get out of them? Is it about knowing that you don't have another take? Is it the music itself? Because that can help. That can be a huge part of it.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of things. It's a lot of things. For me, I found that with TV, there's a lot of you're quite relaxed when you're acting. When I say you are relaxed, I mean like with theater, you have to be on your toes all the time. Mm. Like you have to be thinking about your lines.
There's adrenaline.
Yeah, there's that rush, and you know, the bigger the performance, you feel alive. You feel alive with that, and so with TV, sometimes you just kind of feel like you're just going through emotions here and there and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, I need theater now, and King Kong just came at the right time, and I was like, now that's what I'm going to do now, King Kong. And so, you know, that thing of if anything was to come now, maybe in terms of film or TV, then I'll see where I am, where I want to go, and then I'll decide like that.
Do you know how long you will be touring with King Kong?
Well, there is an intention for us to share the production and this story with the world and with and reach as much of an and as broad of an audience as possible. Yeah. So I do know
this
that
is a whole month at the Joburg,
yes,
at the Mandela Theatre at the Joburg Theatre. So
yes,
they start on this weekend, right? 12th September.
12th September until the 8th.
Next.
Okay,
no,
so it's
next
week.
Week, right?
Yeah. Next week.
It has to be next week because we haven't even rehearsed.
There's no time.
Thursday, oh, Gareth, why? Rehearsals. Why?
Yeah. I'm going to make you nervous.
Why?
You start on the 12th and you finish on the 8th of October. And who knows, it may carry on all over the round, around the rest of the country. And who knows, it might not go international.
Yeah,
they've recently announced a return to Cape Town.
There we go.
Yeah.
See, that's exciting.
March 18th.
Can we talk about that Neverland show that you were on?
The
Michael
movie?
Jackson.
Michael Jackson searching
the movie.
For Neverland.
Yeah. Tell me about that. What was it like? Because you must have done a lot of research and a lot of thinking around Michael Jackson and what kind of a guy he was. And, you know, you might have even been in places where he had been. And, you know, we're all obsessed with this guy, even though he's been gone a couple of years now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was and probably still am a diehard Michael Jackson fan. I mean, MJ was one of the most influential artists in my journey in development as a young artist, I would say. And especially as a young singer-songwriter, you know, he's really someone that I admired and looked up to. It's a very different story. And I think it did need to be told because it's not a story about, it's not a biopic in the broader sense of the journey of his life and highlights from his career and great performances. It's actually, it's based on a book which is concentrated on
The Bodyguard's
book? Yes, yeah, the last 3 years of remembering, Remember the Time, written by his two most trusted bodyguards. And it's based on, it follows and really kind of looks intimately at the last 3 years of his life leading up to his death. And it really is more about the man behind the icon, looks at how his personal life and finances were crumbling and falling apart. And just like any of us, this great man whom we all sort of idolized and hero worshipped was struggling with loneliness and isolation and feeling judged and misunderstood by the world and dealing with people whom he trusted, even in his family and closest circles, exploiting him and betraying him and whatnot. So, that was a revelation, I think, actually. More than anything, I think to some extent it was comforting because we look at these great people whom we idolize and look up to and we think that they have it all figured out. And then when you see their humanity, how deeply human they are, how they are just like you and I and how they struggle with the same things we struggle with, there is something encouraging and comforting, oddly, about that. So I played Grace Ruaramba, who is one of his closest friends and confidants. She worked for his production company for a number of years. And then when he had his children, he asked her to move in with them and help him raise the children. So she became their nanny and lived with him. And so she saw everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything. All of the ins and outs. And even her and Michael had a very kind of tumultuous relationship. And there were lots of ups and downs, and their
there
relationship
couldn't have been
was
too much material for you on Grace. You must have had to really dig deep to find out.
I had
out
to
about
really
that.
Dig, but I was sort of lucky in the sense that, well, one, she's still alive, but two, I was actually able to find some footage of her. She did
really?
A couple of sit down, kind of tell all interviews around the time. Well, there was a lot of controversy in her relationship with Michael
became very fractured at one point, and I think she was very hurt by that. And so, you know, I got to kind of hear her side of the story from her own perspective, and it was very helpful. She's a woman from Rwanda, and I think some of her family come from Uganda as well. So she's East African, and but you know, lived in London and abroad for a number of years, and was very kind of polished and sophisticated and well educated and a worldly woman. So her dialect, kind of like mine, was a bit of a hybrid, and she's just an interesting person who's lived a very interesting and kind of dynamic and international life. And so I was lucky that I could really listen to her, to study her dialect and her mannerisms, and see the way that she moved and the way that she sat. And there are a lot of pictures of her and Michael and the kids. And so that was helpful as well, looking at her fashion, because she was a bit of a fashionista. And, you know, looking at the body language and reading a lot. You know, they say that 70% of human communication is nonverbal. And so actually, as an actor, we were talking about sort of the process and creating a character and what goes into being an actor. Believe it or not, I was studying a lot of those images and just her body language and the kind of physical interaction between her and Michael and the kids helped me a lot, since there wasn't a lot of footage.
Was there a blessing from the family with the movie?
To some extent, yes, because Navi, the gentleman who played Michael, was his official impersonator. Yeah. Michael himself would hire Navi as a decoy to play him. Yeah. So if he needed to go shopping with his kids, or just needed some sort of decoy, he himself, Michael, would hire Navi to be him. That's how flawless his mimicry and his imitation was. So Navi knew Michael and the family and had a really positive relationship with them. So because of him and the family's kind of positive relationship with him, and the fact that he knew Michael and spent time with him, gave our production a lot of integrity and authority, and kind of helped shield us from the potential controversy. So, you know, fans have their opinions about the film, and we respect that, and we understand that as an artist, your responsibility is to create the work and to do the best that you can, and then once you release it into the world, you have to accept that it no longer belongs to you.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to accept but what that comes with.
When you speak of, you know, the humanity that the movie showed, I really think that's accurate, because, you know, having watched it as well.
You watched it?
Don't even get me started on the entire movie.
It's
little scenes like preparing, how Michael had to prepare to go to a mall, for example, going underground and through these tunnels. And you really think, you know, we see Justin Bieber get swamped in a mall all the time. But it's like, hold up, he went with his kids.
Yeah.
And you never know whether someone will jump out with a balloon or a knife or whatever the case is. It's like, oh, shucks, this was a person.
It's dangerous.
And he lived this dangerous life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kudos on you guys for that.
You had a small role in Avengers 2 as well.
Well, I mean, that was really more of just like a little cameo. It was fun, but it's not really.
But to be in a little role like that in a huge blockbuster is still, that's something. I mean, my God, IMDb, they're not going to ignore you. It helps. It comes in. When you've built up a CV like you have, is it easier to get the roles that you really want?
Well, I do believe that work begets work, and certainly, yes. I mean, we were talking about how we approach the business of acting and the industry. I am clear now at this point in my life and career that this is a business, and that I am a businesswoman, and that as a performing artist, you have to approach yourself and look at yourself as a product, essentially, and as kind of a small business owner.
Right.
And be very clear and strategic about what kind of work you want to do and where you want your career to go. And also sometimes make strategic decisions where you may take a smaller role in a bigger franchise film or production with the understanding that it may not be very meaty or exciting for you as the actor, and the material may not be great, but that there is a larger benefit in terms of just your bigger profile and brand in terms of being associated with an entity like that. So you may, you know, so for me, for example, part of that decision was, I mean, it was a really a small kind of tiny cameo role, but I knew that it was a scene with the Hulk. So I'd be on screen with the Hulk, which is one of the main characters. But also, to tell you the honest truth, I got 2 weeks of stunt driving training.
That's pretty cool. That is cool.
And I've got to be really honest with you, that was a big part of the decision, was that, okay, I'm at a point in my career where I've been playing, you know, I've been blessed with lead roles or strong supporting leads in meaningful productions. What's really in this for me? And so you make those kind of strategic decisions. And that was part of it, was actually, sure, this could be really fun. And it's a skill that I don't have. I do have great training and diverse and broad training, now, but stunt driving is not one of them. So how cool
would
that
handle
be?
Joburg traffic, Durban,
you'll be right. Driving in LA. Hello, somebody. Just driving in LA alone, I feel like I deserve an award for that.
Do you go back to Durban sometimes and they say to you, why do you talk like that?
Well, I mean, I've had that my whole life, to tell you the truth. I was born in South Africa and we left when I was 3 years old. So I only spoke Zulu and I learned to speak English in America.
When they say,
Nondumi
song, why do you sound like that?
Well, sometimes it comes from a nasty and malicious place and from a place of judgment without knowing my story and understanding the way that I was raised in my life and just giving me a chance as a human being. And so it doesn't come across in a fun kind of jovial way. There usually is a little bit of a bite to it. Yeah. But I've learned to... One, I just know who I am, and I'm very proud of the woman that I've become.
Hell yeah.
And I know how proud and deeply grounded I am and where I come from and my heritage and how I honor that. And so at this point, people sort of know my story. And
do Americans pronounce your name right?
Not really, but I'm pretty tough on them about it, to tell you the truth, because I just think also there's a level of kind of cultural disrespect when it comes to Africa and African culture and ignorance. And I definitely make a point, even whether I'm meeting Harvey Weinstein for the first time in Beverly Hills in his own studios and about to work in his production and the stakes are high, no, you don't get to meet me and just see my name and say, can I just call you Nabi or Naka or Miso? No, at least make the effort. The same way we as Africans make the effort to reach across the aisle and speak European languages and pronounce.
You do. You speak accents. French and you speak.
Yes. And even just English in terms of. Yeah, in Africa, you know, making that effort.
You speak a little bit of Spanish. You speak a lot of languages.
I do.
Yeah, impressive. I do. Listen,
I'm passionate about languages.
You're a very impressive human being.
Thank you. So are you, Gary?
I would be very worried not to say your name right if I were Harvey Weinstein.
Well, no,
who the hell
listen,
is Harvey Weinstein?
I give people the option to say my nickname, Nondu or Ndumi or Ndu, but at least make the effort. That's all I have to say is, you know, just show respect for me and my culture and just make the effort. That's all I ask. After that, then we can be buddies and you can use my nickname. But that's my stance and I'm pretty tough about it and I'm okay if people get irritated about it because it's a respect thing.
Hey, listen, it's your name.
It's my name.
You don't get to mess with that. That's the one thing. It's the only thing that you can insist on in some situations.
Yeah, exactly.
But both of you have done such an incredible job of flying our flag high and making us proud. And I can't wait for people to see you back in home turf and doing a show that means so much in a country where, you know, this hasn't been put on for such a long time.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to stir up a lot of nostalgia. I think for a lot of people, it's going to be the first time they've ever heard this story about Ezekiel. Right. It's going to be fun to watch. I hope that we get to see you guys. I hope that the show goes on for a couple more weeks and maybe you get to do some international work with it too, because it really is, by the sound of things, terrific.
Yeah.
All the best for King Kong.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you so much. And we hope to see you in the audience.
I will come.
Yes.
I will come. I don't do musicals, but this one sounds
like it. Yeah, and tell us what you think.
You can make an exception.
You can make an exception for this.
Well, you two are hard to say no to.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Having us.
Wow. All right. What an excellent morning this has been. Andile Gumbi and Nondumi Sotembe, thank you so much, guys, for coming to spend some time with us. It's a pleasure to have you here. And come and visit us again soon. All right. Let's go. Let's get this done. Here's what we need to know before you can start your day today. It's the Umhlanga Reed Dance this weekend, where thousands of young maidens are going to make their way to King Goodwill's Relatini's side to prove that they're still virgins. Yes, to make extra sure that they are, Jacob Gedlehlekisa Zuma has booked his annual suite at the Beverly Hills Hotel, where he shall be ushering the girls in and out throughout the weekend for cultural reasons. Cape Town is now on level 5 when it comes to water restrictions. Patricia de Lille is frantically trying to gather all the religious leaders back on Table Mountain to pray for rain, but they aren't having any of it. They're happy to pray prior to storm cells approaching, but outside of winter, that is just asking too much of them. And finally, the Springboks have settled in nicely in Australia ahead of their rugby championship against the Wallabies on Saturday. Each year, the South African fan base grows down under thanks to immigration. So much so that they can do Afrikaans press conferences now. Isn't it all bizarre? It's incredible. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have a good day and blah, blah, blah. You know how it goes.
This is CliffCentral.com.